What's going on, guys? Welcome back to the show. We are going through seven dangerous health and nutrition myths today. Dangerous might sound like an overstatement, but you know, dangerous just meaning causes harm in some way or another. And nutrition myths cause harm because they either directly cause harm, as you'll see some of these do, or because they, you know, indirectly cause harm. Maybe they divert you away from the important stuff, or they affect society overall in some way that might not affect you, you know, today, but affects you either directly or indirectly over time. So I'm going to try not to ramble. I'm recording this on a Sunday afternoon here. I was going to record it Monday, but as I started to make the notes, I just got a little fired up and I thought, why not just capitalize on that anger that you have while making these notes? And so we have seven of these, and without further ado, let's jump into it, because I hope to get this done in an hour, but I'm starting to think that some of these can be podcasts of their own. And so let's see if I can keep it interesting and in-depth, but also not too long that we draw this out for a long time. Number one, we'll kind of get this one out of the way quick, is that seed oils are inflammatory. Again, that is a myth. It is a myth that seed oils are inflammatory. And this one always cracks me up, and we'll get through this one quick because I beat this one to death, but there is not a single study in human beings that has ever shown a downside when you swap out a certain type of fat for, air quote, seed oils, right? Like, you know, when you're like, I don't know if you guys are, you know, this happens to you, but, you know, I'll get arguing with somebody on the internet about something, and ultimately they will go with the defense of, well, you can find a study for anything. This isn't one of those times. Like, this literally isn't one of those times. You can't find a study where somebody, you know, so let's say swaps out butter and starts eating coconut oil, or gets rid of, you know, beef tallow and eats canola oil and has a negative effect. You cannot find a study in human beings where seed oils make something bad happen. You cannot find it. It does not exist. Every single study where people are eating saturated fats, they're eating butter, they're eating ghee, and they swap those out for seed oils, they get healthier, right? They get healthier. Now, I'm not suggesting people go out and actively increase their seed oil consumption, right? I don't think anybody should be going out of their way to actively increase their consumption of any oil, as it is a highly concentrated source of calories and fat. Olive oil maybe comes in as the very minor exception, as high in polyphenol content tends to be associated with really good things, reduction in heart disease and inflammatory markers and stuff like that. But even then, I don't think people should be chugging down olive oil either. You know, people will say things like, oh, but when it's cooked at high temperatures, they get oxidized. And we'll talk about that when we talk about saturated fat in a second. But listen, you'd have to, I was watching a lecture by Alan Flanagan on this, on all of the research we have on this idea of heating seed oils to the point where they oxidize or produce trans fatty acids. You'd have to heat these oils at such high temperatures for so long, or such high temperatures for so long and repeatedly do that. So like cook it, cool it, for there to be a trans fatty acid formation or for negative health outcomes, right? The way to make this happen, so the way to, you know, cook these things at high temperatures repeatedly, if you wanted to get to the point where something bad would happen, it would go completely beyond normal cooking practices, right? I'm going to make this up. I don't remember the exact statistics, but it's like cooking this at, you know, 220 degrees Celsius for like 5 hours straight and then letting it cool and doing that like five times. It's like, oh, then we saw an increase in trans fats. It's like, yeah, but nobody's doing that. Now, you could say that that's something that could happen in, you know, restaurants or fast food joints. I think that could happen, but it wouldn't change if you were using butter, or like if you were repeatedly frying oil and letting it cool and frying it and letting it cool. It doesn't matter if it's beef tallow or butter or canola oil. That's not good for you. So like what you would have to do to make seed oils, air quote, like oxidize and the smoke point and, you know, creation of trans fatty acids, it won't happen in normal cooking processes. You know, people will say things like, oh, but look at how they're made. It's motor oil. It's like, why are you looking at how something is made? Why aren't you looking at what happens when humans consume this thing? I always crack up. It's like, if we didn't have any research on seed oils, right? If there was no research, I think it would be somewhat logical to look at how it's made and see if you could, like, it would be logical to look at some other things, right? And say, okay, can we infer anything from how it's made or, you know, the derivatives or the fatty acid profile? I get that. But we literally have research when humans consume this thing. So why isn't that the research that people look at? They're like, well, look at how it's made. It's like, why don't you look at what happens when you eat it? Are you worried about what happens when you use it as motor oil? Or are you worried about what happens when you consume it? Because we have tons of research and all of it shows that seed oils are not a big deal. They're just nothing to be worried about. In every context, they have a neutral to positive effect on health outcomes. Now, this myth is dangerous, again, because it's a distraction, right? It's something for people to get up in arms about and they forget about the important things. But also the main reason that this is dangerous is because the recommendation is to switch from seed oils, polyunsaturated fats, to saturated fats, tallow, butter, ghee, etc., which ironically, in every, it's hysterical because people are like, hey, don't have seed oils. And you're like, okay, what should I have instead? And they're like, butter, ghee, tallow. The amount of studies where we take habitual tallow eaters or, you know, ghee oil, or we give people ghee for a while and we monitor their blood markers and then we swap that out for canola oil or, cottonseed oil or sesame oil or whatever, some sort of seed oil, some sort of omega-6 oil, people get healthier. It's like, the irony is the recommendation is to switch to saturated fats. But we have studies that literally look at this swap and it tells you in every study, this is a bad swap to make. And so myth number two and myth number three, they're kind of a package deal, is that saturated fat is a superfood and that your cholesterol does not matter. I'm going to try and cover this. The notes I was making when I realized that this should be its own podcast, but let me do my best here. I'll start with saying not all saturated fats are created equal. There are different kinds of saturated fats. Animal fats are particularly high in what's called palmitic acid, which tends to be associated with worse outcomes. There's also, you know, plant-derived saturated fats like dark chocolate. They tend to be high in stearic acid. Again, those are palmitic acid and stearic acid, both saturated fats, but different fat profile. And stearic acid, specifically dark chocolate in its whole form, has a neutral to positive effect on health outcomes. So I will say saturated fat is technically a catch-all term for all types of saturated fat, but I'm talking mostly in the context of saturated fat from animal foods, as this tends to be what people are talking about. Nobody's waging war on dark chocolate. Dark chocolate tends to be associated with really good things, high in polyphenols, high in fiber, and the stearic acid content seems to not be a big deal. So again, mostly talking about this in the context of animal fats, beef, you know, butter, dairy, et cetera. Some of the common arguments you see to kind of try and buffer this myth, we see like these historical or evolutionary arguments. Our ancestors ate a lot of animal fats, or traditional cultures like the Inuit ate high fat diets. Human beings have been eating saturated fat for millions of years. It's like, this is not... It's again, if you want to go this historical evolutionary route, like I see where that route can be like a logical place to go for people, but we have studies on this in humans in modern day. Like that stuff might be interesting if we didn't have loads and loads and truckloads of research on people in today's age, saturated fat intake, LDL cholesterol. Like that argument is like an intellectual discussion that can be interesting. But then you just look at the last, you know, even just the last like 10 years of data, and it is unequivocal, right? People will make, you know, certain biochemical claims like cholesterol is essential for hormone production. It is. Guess what? Your body makes enough cholesterol on its own. They'll say things like, again, saturated fat is stable, doesn't oxidize like polyunsaturated fats. Just like we talked about, people think that you cook the oil at a certain temperature for a certain length of time and it oxidizes, breaks down, and becomes inflammatory in the body. And again, the amount of heating and time you'd have to heat the oils and the amount of reheating you'd have to do to make this an issue goes far beyond normal cooking practices. they'll say things like the brain needs saturated fat to function. That's true. But again, you know, the body can synthesize the saturated fat that it needs, right? There's no evidence that eating more improves brain function, and your brain also needs unsaturated fats, essential fatty acids, EPA, DHA. And so, you know, I crack up, and this is something I was going to make leads us into our next myth, but people will say things like fiber is non-essential. Like I'll say, all right, you know, carnivore people, they're like, oh, you don't need fiber. It's not essential. By the way, non-essential just means you won't die if you don't consume it, right? And saturated fat is not essential either. Like the kings of saturated fat, these carnivore dieters are basing all of their avoidance on plants around the idea that fiber is not essential. Saturated fat's not essential, dude. It just kills me. They'll do the whole anti-industry thing. You know, the anti-saturated fat message was driven by these studies that were funded by biased sources, you know, by the vegetable industry, by the sugar industry. It's just lazy arguments. Like, we have decades of research from all the way from epidemiological research to RCTs to Mendelian randomization that shows, again, increased saturated fat intake leads to increased LDL cholesterol, and most notably ApoB leads to increased risk of heart disease and also other things too, other which we're going to get into in just a second. But, you know, and this is an interesting place where you can find some studies where you compare two groups where one group is eating more saturated fat and there is no difference in risk of heart disease, right? There are studies out there where, you know, group A eats some saturated fat, group B eats more saturated fat, and there's no difference in, let's say, heart disease outcomes. And those are interesting studies, but when you look at them, they're usually comparing groups, either both eating really low saturated fat, but just one is a little higher, or both really high saturated fats where one is higher. And what we see is that, and I don't want to go too deep into the, just like the shape of this curve here, but, you know, if you're eating, let's say, below 10% total calories from saturated fat, if one group is eating like 6% and the other group is eating like 9%, because those are both below a certain threshold that we have seen in the literature at around 10% total calories, you won't see any difference in outcomes. So a lot of people, when they, you know, send me these papers, it's like, yeah, both of these groups weren't eating a lot of saturated fat. So even though one was eating a little bit more, they were both below the threshold. And that threshold, again, tends to be around 10% total calories or less than 10% total calories, maybe 8% for, I think there are some organizations that say 8% now, but 10% total calories. So here's the deal. Lots of saturated fat in the diet will lead to an increase in LDL or ApoB, and by extension, your risk of heart disease, all else being equal. Lots of saturated fat in the diet also associated with increased risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. You know, high saturated fat diets tend to lead to more ectopic or visceral fat gained in and around your organs, especially when in conjunction with a calorie surplus. We see reduced insulin sensitivity. You know, people are like, oh, cholesterol is important for every cell in the body, so you should eat more of it. It's like, dude, the body produces its own cholesterol. Liver produces about 80% of the cholesterol your body needs by itself. These people are confusing necessity with quantity, right? Just because something is essential, by the way, saturated fat is essential. Cholesterol is essential, but your body will make the cholesterol that it needs. So cholesterol is essential. Saturated fat is not essential. Just because something is essential doesn't mean more is better, right? I mean, water is essential, but you can drink too much water and die. Vitamin A is essential, but too much can be toxic. Oxygen is essential, but, you know, too much can cause oxidative damage, whatever. Carbs are not essential. Fiber is not essential. Yes, that's like a classic argument, Jordan Peterson, Max Lugavere podcast sort of argument. Just wait until they hear that saturated fat is non-essential, that you don't need to be eating saturated fat. Are you going to stop eating? Of course not. Of course these people aren't. It doesn't fit their bias, right? And now I want to be very clear. Let me wrap this part up. I'm not saying you can't have saturated fat in your diet and be healthy. Of course you can. But the idea of I can have this thing in my diet and still be healthy is not the same as more is better, right? This is one that directly is doing harm. It's not a distraction. It's directly doing harm. People will die because of this advice. People will die because there are groups of people that are flexing their high LDL from their incredibly high, you know, animal fat-based diet as a good thing, as a marker of health. And so, you know, if you want to learn a bit more about, you know, some people will say, well, I'm metabolically healthy otherwise, but I happen to have high LDL, right? These people have been coined lean mass hyper responders. And if you're interested in that phenotype, that type of person, which by the way is incredibly rare. I have two podcasts on it. You can scroll back there maybe, I don't know, 15, 20 episodes ago, maybe 10, 15 episodes ago. One with Nick Norwitz, one with Alan Flanagan. I would listen to them maybe in that order as well. But even, you know, just to wrap that up, even the people who are doing research on these, you know, seemingly metabolically healthy individuals who have high LDL, as of recording, they currently will still recommend you bring down your ApoB or your LDL, your non-HDL cholesterol, which in many cases means increasing fiber intake, decreasing saturated fat intake, among other things for sure. Myth number four, food dyes and obsession with single ingredients are going to radically change our nation's health. What is the danger here? The danger is distraction. As I'm sitting here, I'm all for getting rid of food dyes. If you could snap our fingers and we just got rid of all food dyes and, you know, natural flavors and these non-nutritive additives to food that don't provide meaningful nutrition. And I will say that even things that don't provide meaningful nutrition are really important, certain preservatives that extend shelf life, that, you know, increase crop yield. We'll talk a little bit more about that. It's not the case that just because something is not non-nutritive, it's not additive to your health, that it should be eradicated from our food system. That is not logical. But okay, you want to get rid of food dyes that are clearly just to make a food look more appealing, right? If that's the main purpose of food dyes, I'm down to get rid of them. But from a public health perspective, this isn't going to do anything. And so far, there's like, you know, the counter to this is, and if you feel what I'm about to say, if you are somebody who feels the way I am about to describe, I'm not coming at you, just I disagree, that's all. People have said, well, it's a good start. What I will say to you is this discussion of banning food dye happened months ago, prior to the new government administration coming in, and it has not proven to be a good start. We have continued down a route for the last several months of majoring in the minors, ignoring the real social determinants of health, the things that keep our population sick. We have not used this as a good start. We are just continuing to be distracted with things that won't really make a big difference. And again, you know, people will say, well, it's, you know, they'll look at a certain ingredient and they'll be like, oh, it's banned in Europe. It's like, first of all, there's different regulatory systems for our country and other countries. In many cases, are these foods not banned in other countries. They just have a different name. But there are just as many things banned in the United States that are deemed safe in other countries. Other countries might take a, you know, different take on the literature, right? All these countries are looking at the same literature, and based on how they view the literature, they'll make recommendations for their country. But if you think there are things that are not banned here that are legal elsewhere, you're kidding yourself. There's a ton of things that are banned here that are, you know, deemed safe elsewhere, right? Just today, I'm just speaking a bit from the heart here. Just today, I saw a couple in Costco. I was in Costco this morning doing our food shop, and I saw them early on in my Costco run, and they were reading the ingredients to something. I couldn't really see what was what they were saying, but it did stick in my head of like, these people, they were in larger bodies, let's say. And I don't know anything about them, and I don't mean to project, but the thought came into my head of like, that's like the fact that this is a worry that you have. You're flipping over ingredients. You're worried about, oh, this one has natural flavors, I got to put it back. Or you're scanning the barcode with like some app that tells you if it's healthy or not, is in all likelihood distracting you from the fact that you should go to the produce section, buy a whole bunch of shit there, go to the meat section and fish section, buy a whole bunch of stuff there, you know, skip the snacks aisle, you know, like, you know, exercise, all that stuff. And again, I don't know these people. And the thought just came into my mind and I felt compelled to share. I was like, what are we doing to people, man? Like, what are we doing? You know, you know, are we putting somebody flipping over diet soda and be like, no, I got to put this back. It's got aspartame. Like, we're just majoring in the minors. We're just stepping over dollars to pick up pennies, you know, insert any of those analogies there, you know? And at the end of the day, what we are doing is we're ignoring the social determinants of health. And if you've heard that term thrown around, but you're not necessarily sure what it means, a social determinant of health is any, you know, non-biological factor in the environment where people are born, live, learn, work, play, and people's age that affects health outcomes, right? Health outcomes, their, you know, functioning, their risks, their quality of life, basically things that don't, that you didn't get to pick, that have to do with our society at large, wealth distribution, et cetera, educational differences. You know, people often spout out statistics about how fat and sick we are. We're like, oh, 40% of our country's obese, 70% of us are overweight. Nobody talks about stuff that, like, the life expectancy gap is like 10 to 15 years between the highest and lowest income brackets, right? Poor people, let me be clear, poor people, there's not a poor person who is psyched about removing food dyes. No, nobody living in a food desert, you know, with you know, doesn't have a good enough access to nutritious food, working a bunch of jobs, you know, in a lower income place is psyched about food dyes. They need better access to healthcare, you know, more livable wages, more walkable cities, improved access to and cheaper nutritious foods, stable housing, better schools, more parks, clean air and water. They're not psyched about food dyes. Again, you wanna, you know, get rid of food dyes. I'm all for it. If it is not getting in the way of us tackling these social determinants of health. If you want to learn a bit more about this, I would follow Dr. Jessica Nernick, accounts like, who else? Nini in the Brain, Dr. Andrea Love, all really, really good accounts, and there are many more, but I'm always going to forget people when I'm just blabbering them out there. We're getting through this pretty quick here. I thought I would have gotten just lost in the saturated fat as a superfood one. It's crazy. Your body makes the saturated fat it needs, and every study we do, people have higher LDL, worse shit happens. And the research on increasing saturated fat intake from animal foods increases your LDL is like ironclad. Again, in most people, right? Some people can eat more saturated fat and don't see as much of an LDL increase or ApoB increase, and other people can eat less saturated fat and see a great increase in LDL cholesterol. But that outcome, cause and effect, is has been established. Myth number five, vegetables are bad for you. You know, this will sound something like the vegetables are high in oxalates. These are certain defense chemicals that, you know, these plants have evolved in such a way that they don't want their fruit, their seeds, their flour being eaten by certain animals. They only want it to be eaten by other animals that will propagate. And so they're high in these things called oxalates, which are inflammatory in the body, blah, 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 blah. Dude, this is like mechanism over outcome 101. This is when people take a mechanism that sounds scary or sounds interesting, and they will assume that it leads to certain outcomes. Now, mechanistic data and mechanistic rationale and logic is super duper meaningful when it comes to deciding what sort of science to use. But human beings are very complex, and a single mechanism does not decide an outcome. An outcome, health outcome, like having a heart attack or even like elevated ApoB or, you know, increase in blood sugar, risk of diabetes. These are outcomes that are brought about by the combination of many, many, many mechanisms. And so when someone's like, oh, this is oxalates or these defense chemicals that your body doesn't want to eat and, you know, cause all this bad stuff to happen, it's like, okay, like if that was true, what we would see is that people who eat more high oxalate food, by the way, when I say oxalates, I literally just mean like, I'm not going to go into very specific foods, but let's assume people mean fruits and vegetables. Every study ever done where people eat these foods more, good stuff happens. Like, if this was meaningful, wouldn't it amass or aggregate towards something bad happening, right? You're like, hey, don't eat this thing. It's bad for you. It's like, okay, like, there's these people over here that are eating a ton of it. And when I say these people over here, I mean every study ever been done ever people eat more fruits and vegetables, good stuff happens, right? Oxalates are just like, I guess I'll go a little bit, but they're naturally occurring compounds. They're found in many healthy foods. They do things like bind to calcium and they, you know, can form kidney stones if you are specifically susceptible. Like most healthy people can process and eliminate oxalates effectively. They do not need to worry about it. And the benefits of eating high oxalate foods, which are fruits and vegetables, far outweigh the risks. Like foods are a matrix, a nutrition matrix of many different things. Okay, this food, spinach, has oxalates. It also has other things like fiber and phytochemicals and micronutrients that are valuable for health that make it on the net balance of all those things, something additive to your health in a good, very good way. The body has mechanisms to handle dietary oxalates. And even if it kind of didn't, you know, these people will never say this, but cooking methods dramatically reduce oxalate content, right? If you are concerned about oxalate content, you know, boiling your vegetables can reduce oxalate content by like 80% or more, depending on the vegetable. So if you hear people say the word oxalate or defense chemicals, they are extrapolating poorly on a mechanism that, although it exists, does not have a meaningful impact on humans. And if you were to avoid all high oxalate foods, you'd be avoiding a whole bunch of really healthy foods you should be eating more of. Which brings me to myth number 6, that fiber is non-essential. Now, this is not a myth. Fiber is non-essential. You do not need fiber to live. But something being non-essential and thus you shouldn't eat it is a stupid argument. Again, same. I would not ever say, hey, saturated fat, it's not essential for life, and so it serves no purpose at all. You should absolutely avoid it. No, it being essential or not is not on the list of reasons that I think you should limit your saturated fat intake from animal foods to less than 10% total calories. It's because, you know, I did that already, but it's okay. Increase saturated fat intake from animal foods, increase LDL ApoB, increased risk of heart disease, all other things equal. So something essential or not essential doesn't tell us if it is helpful or helpful to our health, healthful, if it's good for us, if we should have more of it or less of it. Like, again, people who eat more fiber die less with like no upper limit to the benefit, right? With no upper limit. We've looked at fiber intakes and what we're looking for typically is, hey, is there an upper limit where fiber, the benefits of fiber become non-existent, or maybe that more fiber becomes bad? We haven't found it. People who eat more fiber die less, period. You know, it promotes regular bowel movement, you know, feeds beneficial gut bacteria. You know, when you feed these beneficial gut bacteria, the gut bacteria create beneficial, what are called short-chain fatty acids in the gut that have a good impact on our body. You know, it can help prevent colorectal cancer, improves, you know, gut microbiome diversity. You know, everyone wants to talk about the microbiome. Like the one of the only things we really know about the microbiome, and when I say really know, we still don't really know all of this stuff, is that diversity is helpful. And a diet full of diverse whole plant foods is one of the best ways to take care of your gut health, let's say. Associated with improvements in insulin sensitivity, aids in weight management by increasing satiety, can help lower cholesterol levels, reduce risk of type 2 diabetes, help maintain healthy blood pressure. You know, again, creates feeling of fullness. We did all of those other ones. Like, yes, you can survive without fiber. You'd just be a lot healthier if you didn't, you know, in the Matthew McConaughey voice here. And if she doesn't know what movie that's from, she's too young for you, bro. And again, this myth is dangerous because what the fuck, man? Vegetables are good. Like, it's not complicated. This is a dangerous myth. And again, the myth is that because fiber is not essential, you shouldn't eat it, or that it's not helpful to your health. That is just categorically not true. Number 7 is our last one here. Yeah, number 7. Oh, no. I hope I can get through this without breaking down my brain. Is that natural equals safe and healthy? And that synthetic, or, you know, made by man, is bad, right? Essentially, this underlying appeal to nature or naturalistic fallacy, right? Like, natural substances can be highly toxic. And I'm going to start with one that is near and dear to my heart, and that I say that tongue in cheek, and I don't want to make light of this, but botulinum toxin. I have a post right now that's going, you know, it's on like 2.5 million views where some lady is comparing, you know, giving your child honey to like giving your child like baby formula and thinking that those are analogous to one another. Dude, giving your newborn infant child honey can kill them. It can give them botulism. They're not ready to deal with the botulinum toxin. Their bacteria is not, or they're not ready to deal with that bacteria, let's just say. And botulism is no fucking joke. And it's guess what? It's found naturally in nature. It is the most potent toxin known, right? And on the flip side, synthetic substances can be very safe. You know, lab-created vitamins, B12, vitamin C, often more reliable than natural sources. Most modern antibiotics are, guess what? Lab-created and, you know, safely save millions of lives every year. Synthetic insulin, right? Crucial for diabetics, very safe when properly dosed. You know, another example is like, people are all about water purity right now, you know, purifying their water, reverse osmosis. Reverse osmosis is a synthetically purified water, but guess what? It's completely safe and it's an amazing way to filter your water. And, you know, this, you know, again, some artificial food preservatives like citric acid, you know, extensively tested for safety, improved food availability, are not dangerous to us in any way, shape, or form. And this whole naturalist fallacy tends to piggyback on a misunderstanding of dose-dependent effects. The dose makes the poison. An example, right now, the current ADI, which is acceptable daily intake for aspartame, is like 50 milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day. And before we talk about, you know, how many cans of diet soda you'd have to meet to reach that, the ADI, the way that we come to a consensus on an acceptable daily intake is usually, you know, we'll find an amount of a substance that causes any harm. And then we will make the ADI 1% of that amount, right? So let's say there's a rat study or something and we see that, you know, or a human study and we start to see that there is, you know, you have 100 of something and at 99, there was no downside. And at 100, we started to see something bad happening. We will place the ADI at 1. We will place the ADI at 1. So ADI has this built-in safety margin of 100 times. So when I say that the ADI for aspartame is 50 milligrams per kilogram per body weight per day, that isn't that 51 milligrams per kilogram per body of body weight per day has been shown to have a downside. It's that 5,000 milligrams per kilogram of body weight per day is predicted to have a downside. So what do? We take 1% of that and we make it the ADI. Now, given that it is 1%, it would still take you for, let's say, 150-pound person, that's like 18 cans of diet soda every day or per day every day. And then you would probably see some downside, right? It's just insane. It's insane. The ignoring the dose makes the poison is insane, right? You can't, and this is what happens. People will flip over the package and they will see an ingredient and they'll think, oh, either I've heard that's bad for me or that's not natural. And they will put it back and they'll think, oh, that's bad for me. It's not natural, without any understanding for how much of that thing is in their food, and what do the studies show when we look at human beings and the consumption of this thing in this amount? People are all worried about glyphosate and, you know, whatever sort of preservative or something. These foods have very little of that. Artificial sweeteners are a big one. Now, again, if you want to avoid that stuff, you know, whatever, that's your prerogative, but this misunderstanding of, oh, it's man-made and thus bad, or there's any amount of this thing in here, it must be bad, is just not a scientific line of thinking. And if you adopt that logic, I think it creates a really tough life where there's no way you can keep that logic in all facets. Like, then it's like, oh, don't have anything in your diet where if you had an astronomical amount of it, it would be bad. Again, don't have any saturated fat. Don't have any nutrient, because like we just talked about, vitamin E can be toxic at high levels. Like, don't have any nutrient that if you had an astronomical amount of it would be bad. There are so many nutrients and things in your life, in your world, where if you had an astronomical amount, it would be bad. And so it's kind of a slippery slope, a logic that you can't possibly stay aligned with. It ends up just being, you know, cherry picking times where you feel like, you know, giving into this naturalist fallacy. Right, these sorts of things, they lead to an avoidance of evidence-based medical treatments and create a false security around kind of natural remedies, right? If people are just, oh, this is, medication is all of a sudden bad, you know? Certain practices like pasteurization are now bad, right? We need to go back to the old days of drinking raw milk and before we had vaccines. It's like, dude, we pasteurize milk for a reason. We have vaccines for a reason. Don't get me started. Raw milk, like I on that same post about the botulinum toxin, there's a comment about raw milk, and the arguments for raw milk are just insane. I'm just going to say it now. We're not going to cover raw milk. I don't even think it deserves its own myth here. Raw milk has zero extra nutritional benefits and is estimated to be about 840 times more likely to carry foodborne illness. Right. It's not that I think if you drink a sip of raw milk, you're going to drop dead. That is not true. I do not think that. I think on the scheme of things, it's probably not that dangerous, but there is no benefit, right? There's no extra benefit, and there is an additional risk. What sorts of things in your life do you do that have no benefit, but have an extra risk? Right, that doesn't make any sense. Like, I have people arguing with me that it's not that dangerous. I'm like, if you want to tell me it's not that dangerous, what you're admitting to me is that it is more dangerous than pasteurized milk. And if it's more dangerous than pasteurized milk and you want to drink it, you must have evidence that it is beneficial in some way. And it's not. And it's not. And this whole naturalist fallacy goes into this bucket of, you know, what we would coin like chemophobia or fear of chemicals. You know, the one that kills me is GMOs and organic foods. Listen, genetically modified organisms or whatever, foods, GMO foods. Like, GMOs are fucking awesome, right? There is no evidence of any harm in decades of use. We've been modifying plant genetics for thousands of years. You know, GMOs reduce pesticide use, which people don't want to talk about because it doesn't fit their fear of pesticides. GMOs actually help you use less pesticides. They improve drought resistance, increase yields, reduce food waste, and in many cases, enhance nutritional content when possible. That the GMOs benefit us as a society in one way or another with never, ever been shown to have a downside. They are extensively safety tested before approval. And again, you know, the major scientific consensus on GMO safety is that they are unequivocally safe and not something to be worried about. But the problem is, by now, because I've said the scientific consensus and I've used the word evidence, somebody's going to go, you know, back up to the opinion of, well, that science is corrupt and bought and paid for. And I can't even go into that right now. And organic food is just not, on average, not any more nutritious, just way more expensive. Mostly just a made up thing when it comes to a marketing tool, essentially, to make it seem like it's safer or more healthy. We have tested conventional produce versus organic produce, and on the whole, they have the same nutritional value, period. These same naturalistic fallacy people will be like, there's just this, right now there's this movement, there's like a very mistrust in science, mistrust in, you know, government, this like, people want to return to the good old times, right? They want to have less regulation, they want to have less pesticides, less science, less telling me what to do. Like, a return to the good old times, you say? When in 1900, when life expectancy was like 30 years less, I think it was like 45 or 47. Life expectancy lately is like 77, 76. We want to go back to the good old times. I mean, infant mortality is down, like, you know, it was like 30 times higher 100 years ago. Over 30. What did I write? 165 deaths per thousand. Today, 5.4 deaths per thousand. And yeah, you know, whatever. You can talk about the United States versus other developed nations. But unbelievable public health interventions. Guess what? By man, in the good times, which are now, we have cleaner water, better sanitation systems, widespread vaccination programs that save countless, countless lives, food safety regulations, improved maternal care, antibiotics, modern surgeries, neonatal care, better understanding of nutrition. Like, I don't understand what is with this obsession of returning to the good old times. We live in just like factually the greatest time that there has ever been. So this one, the naturalist fallacy runs deep. And I know that there were things in this rant that are, that go deeper than just naturalist fallacy, but they tend to come as a package deal. This, you know, naturalist fallacy, chemophobia, fear of organic, fear of conventional produce, fear of GMOs, fear of vaccines. Do you drink raw milk? You know, don't tell me what to do. The food pyramid was a lie. Government recommendations are wrong. There's just this anti-establishment vibe that tends to come as a package deal here. It just rots my brain. So I'm going to call it there. I'm pretty proud we got that through that in 40 minutes. I may extrapolate. I think the truth is I need to do maybe a big episode on fiber, a big episode on saturated fat and cholesterol. I have an episode on seed oils with Dr. Adrian Chavez, which I think we did it like 2 years ago, but it still holds incredibly true today. Not literally nothing has changed because, again, there's never been a study in humans that shows anything bad happening. If you are interested in me diving in any deeper to any of these topics in particular, you can shoot me a DM. You guys have been really great with leaving 5-star reviews and written reviews on iTunes and 5-star review on Spotify. I'm going to keep mentioning it because it really does help. For the first several years of this podcast, I did not ask people to leave reviews. And I don't regret that. But since asking for them, a lot of you guys have done it. And it just takes a second. And it really does help. It really does. And I really appreciate it. And I really do appreciate the kind words, especially the ones on iTunes. They mean a lot. Thank you. Next week or in 2 weeks, next week will be a Q&A episode. In 2 weeks, we will drop some, you know, whatever, top 5 to 10 training myths of today. So I appreciate you guys listening. Have a good one. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.